was born in Lebanon, but left there with his parents in the late 1970s because of the civil war in Lebanon. He did a master's degree at the London School of Economics and took his doctorate at Oxford University. He has taught at Oxford, Harvard, and Columbia, and was a research fellow at Princeton University for 2 years. He's been the recipient of 3 prestigious fellowships, the MacArthur, the Fulbright, and the Carnegie Fellowship. He was a senior ABC television news analyst from 2000 to 2006, when he left to reside in the Middle East as a Carnegie Scholar. As a Carnegie Scholar, he was able to spend 15 months in field study in the Middle East. He's interviewed hundreds of civil society leaders, activists, and mainstream and radical Islamists in the Muslim world and within Muslim communities in Europe. Dr. Jirgis has given scores of interviews for media outlets throughout the world, including ABC and CNN, BBC, PBS, CBC, and Al Jazeera. He's been a guest on a number of interview shows, including The Charlie Rose Show, The Oprah Winfrey Show, Bill Moyers Journal, and The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Our speaker has also written extensively in newspapers and journals, including, among many others, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The LA Times, The International Herald Tribune, Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, and The Middle East Journal. His books include America and Political Islam, Clash of Cultures, or Clash of Interests, The Superpowers in the Middle East, Regional and International Politics, The Far Enemy, Why Jihad Went Global, and The Journey of a Jihadist Inside Muslim Militancy. The last one is the most recent book, and the one that's on will be on sale after the lecture. We're very privileged to have this well-known scholar, and I would ask you to welcome him now.
Thanks, Ken. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you, Anne, and good evening. It's really wonderful to have you here on Valentine evening. It's very impressive, and the privilege is mine. I just wish we could speak about love and life instead of war and death. I think that would have been quite a treat for all of us. My assignment tonight, I was asked to speak about the future of Al-Qaeda or inside Al-Qaeda. That is, what's happening within Al-Qaeda itself as an organization. And instead of really making any speculating about Al-Qaeda, what I want to do today is to look inside the organization itself. That is to say, I want to take a balance sheet of what has happened to Al-Qaeda in the last 8 years, in particular since 9/11, even though as a student of militant organizations, I have been researching social movements, fringe since the 1990s, long before 9/11 and long before jihadism became a household name in the United States and Western countries. And I think what has happened after 9/11, now you have a huge industry, specialists on Al-Qaeda, but really the truth is we cannot understand this particular beast without really locating Al-Qaeda within the cultural and historical context of Middle Eastern politics and foreign policy. The first question I want to address tonight, and I hope to address tonight, is that what is the nature of Al-Qaeda's threat today? That is, where is Al-Qaeda today as opposed to 9/11 or the 1990s? I think this is a critical question for all of us, and I hope today to shed some light on this particular question. Does Al-Qaeda today, 8 years after the United States declared a global war on terror, does it have a viable popular base? That is, has Al-Qaeda's base expanded since 9/11, or rather shrunk in the last 8 years? How does Muslim public opinion, the view Al-Qaeda after 8 years of turmoil and an all-out war waged by Al-Qaeda and the United States and the international community as well. How effective is Al-Qaeda's recruitment strategy? That is, has Al-Qaeda been able to recruit more activists to basically wage global jihad against the United States and America's allies in the last 7 years? Are young Arabs and Muslims basically receptive, or are receptive, have been receptive to Al-Qaeda's tactics and rhetoric, in particular in the last 8 years? I'm going to focus in my focus tonight because, I mean, I could talk about how Al-Qaeda was born, and I will say a few words about it, but I'm interested in particular with today's question, where is Al-Qaeda today, and how does Muslim public opinion and Muslim public at large view Al-Qaeda? To summarize, does Al-Qaeda have a future, or has Al-Qaeda reached a dead end 8 years after 9/11? And what I will say tonight is really based on research I've been doing in the last 3 years in particular. I spent about 15 months, as Anne said, doing research, interviewing former radicals and religiously oriented activists in several Muslim countries. And please remember, I will be basically talking sometimes, talking about certain terms. So please, I would be delighted to try to answer any questions you have at the end of the talk, because this is a very complex topic, and I'm not patronizing, a very difficult topic, and I will be throwing certain terms on the table here. So if I do, please try to ask me to elaborate on some of the questions after the talk. Let me start by saying the first point I want to make tonight is that the global jihadist movement, as opposed to the local jihadist movement, has always been a poor cousin in the Muslim world. The global jihadist movement that targets external enemies, as opposed to the local jihadist movement that targets Muslim governments and Muslim rulers. That is, there has never been a huge market and a huge constituency for the global jihadist movement like Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a global jihadist movement. Its target mainly is the far enemy. The far enemy meaning the United States and its close Western allies. Let me simplify by giving you an example of what I mean, that the global jihadist movement has always been a fringe, tiny movement in the Muslim world. At the height of its power, in the late 1990s, and this might come as a shocking surprise to you, at the height of its power in 1999, Al-Qaeda never numbered more than 3,000 or 4,000 militants or fighters and terrorists. 4,000, and this is a consensus among both academics and the intelligence communities in the United States and the Western countries. 4,000 fighters. You might say this is a large number. But we students of social movements, we measure strengths by what we call the social base. Well, surely 4,000 fighters or militant or terrorist could be very deadly in terms of, fighting power, but that's not a major social movement. Today's Al-Qaeda, it's estimated today, 8 years after 9/11, the numbers are in the low hundreds. The numbers range between 300 and 500 militants or terrorists 8 years after 9/11. And those are not just my numbers. Those are the numbers that are relatively agreed upon by the American intelligence community and the Western intelligence communities, and also independent scholars and researchers. We might be wrong. Take 100 or two. So you might say, why do you say still a small movement? In the late 1990s, Al-Qaeda numbered 4,000 militants or fighters, one militant local jihadist movement. Remember, this is Al-Qaeda, is a global jihadist movement. one local jihadist movement. In the late 1990s, it was called the Islamic Group, or Al-Gama'a Al-Islamiyya in Egypt, numbered more than 100,000 fighters or activists or militants. One group. It's called Al-Gama'a Al-Islamiyya, or the Islamic Group. Another one, called Egyptian Islamic Jihad, run by Ayman Zawahiri. Ayman Zawahiri is second in command of Al-Qaeda, numbered 20,000 militants or fighters in the late 1990s, and they waged a local jihad assault against local governments. Those movements were interested in targeting local Muslim governments as opposed to targeting the far enemy. The far enemy, they referred to the Western powers, in particular the United States, as the far enemy. And what I'm trying to suggest to you here is that when we talk about Al-Qaeda and the global jihadist movement, we must contextualize this particular movement and realize, despite its danger, despite its insidious danger, it remains a relatively fringe movement as opposed to a viable social movement. The big point I'm trying to make is that since its birth in the second half of the 20th century, the jihadist movement, the local jihadist movement, and please bear with me, I want to just say a few words about the history so we can talk about, where the jihadist movement was and where it is today. Since its birth in the second half of the 20th century, the major targets of the jihadist movement have been what we call the near enemy, local Arab and Muslim rulers and governments as opposed to Western governments. That is, most radicalized religious activists in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s and 90s were interested in basically toppling what they perceived to be secular Arab and Muslim governments for failing to rule according to Islamic law or Sharia. They basically were unsettled by the secular nature of governments in their own societies. They were not interested in targeting Western countries. Of course, they had nothing positive to say about Western countries, but their major, their basic focal target was internal governments in their societies, not Western societies. And what I'm trying to suggest here is that the global jihadist movement, Al-Qaeda, was not born until the late 1990s. I mean, think about it with me. I mean, the movement itself was born in the 1950s. And the major target of the movement was, we said, local Arab and Muslim governments. The global jihadist movement was not born until the 1990s, when the local jihadist movement became exhausted and on the brink of collapse. In the 1990s, the local jihadist movement that targeted Arab and Muslim governments became exhausted on the brink of collapse. And in fact, contrary to received wisdom in my country, in the United States, the birth of Al-Qaeda, the global jihadist movement in the 1990s, represented a monstrous mutation, the movement that was on its last gasp, that is, the movement itself was dying, as a result that the local jihadist movement was defeated in Algeria, in Egypt, and elsewhere. The ship was sinking in the 1990s, and the question was, how do we rescue the sinking ship? How do we salvage what we could do? That was the debate in the 1990s, because the local jihadist movement was defeated on the local battlefield. And the debate that raged in the 1990s, what to do? Where do we go from here? The bulk of militants, the bulk of militant activists decided to call it quit in 1997. That is 98%. Those are numbers. I didn't invent those numbers. Those are real. And 98% of the local jihadists declared a unilateral ceasefire. They said, we were defeated, let's take a break, let's see where we go from here. And in 1997, basically in Egypt, in Algeria, and elsewhere, there was a major unilateral ceasefire declared by the movements I mentioned to you earlier, the Islamic group, Al-Jama'a al-Islamiyya in Egypt, by the Islamic Egyptian Jihad and other movements as well. But a minority within the jihadist movement decided to fight on. Even though 98% of the jihadist movement decided to quit, a minority decided to fight on. But this time, not against the near enemy, this time against what they call the head of the snake. The head of the snake was referred to as the United States of America and its close Western allies. Ayman Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden, the top leaders of this particular faction that basically decided to take jihad global, from jihad, we said, up to the 1990s, was local. But Ayman Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden decided to take jihad global in the 1990s because they wanted to create a world crisis, in their words, a world crisis, and to get the United States to be bogged down in the region's shifting sands. And basically, this particular faction would stand up and defend the Muslim community, the Muslim Ummah, and as a result, we would gain credibility in the eyes of the Ummah. In the late 1990s, Ayman Zawahiri was writing memos to his field lieutenants. He said, the only way we can rescue the sinking ship was to transform our movement from a movement that targets Arab and Muslim governments in order to target the Western countries, because that was the only way that we could survive and we could create a viable social base. In fact, I would argue that the main target of 9/11, the main target, the primary audience of 9/11 was not the Western audience. The primary audience of 9/11 was not America, it was in the Muslim country itself. Ayman Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden wanted to convince the Muslim public that they were the vanguard, they were the fighters, they were the people who were defending the Muslim community, because they expected the United States, in the late 1990s, according to the memos that we read by Ayman Zawahiri, they expected the United States to lash out angrily, quote unquote, against the Muslim community, and then Ayman Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden and their faction would stand up and defend the Muslim community. In his words, we would gain credibility in the eyes of the Muslim community. We would survive the assault by Muslim rulers. I said earlier that contrary to the received wisdom in the United States, Al-Qaeda was born out of mutation, not strengths. This is the first argument I put on the table. The second argument I want to make tonight is that contrary to received wisdom also in the United States, 9/11 did not turn out to be as good as Osama bin Laden, Ayman Zawahiri expected 9/11 to turn out. Osama bin Laden, after 9/11, he said, if the United States dares to invade Afghanistan, we would have a river, quote unquote, of recruits who would come to Afghanistan and defend Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Well, what happened when the United States invaded Afghanistan in October 2001? What happened to the river of recruits that Osama bin Laden expected? In fact, the river of recruits turned out to be a trickle. Fewer than dozens of Muslim activists decided to go to Afghanistan and fight on behalf of the Taliban and Osama bin Laden. Not only, you remember I mentioned earlier, I said almost 90% of the local jihadist movement decided to call it quit. So here you have hundreds of thousands of decommissioned militants and activists who could have joined Al-Qaeda in its fight against the United States. Imagine for a moment if those hundreds of thousands of fighters or militants decided to take sides and fight with Al-Qaeda. I said a minute ago, only dozens as opposed to a river of recruits. Not only they stayed on the sidelines, the top leadership of the local jihadist movement vehemently criticized Al-Qaeda for endangering the very survival of the Islamic community and the Islamist movement as a whole. I know I'm simplifying a great deal. When I say that the top leadership, I'm talking about dozens of books, hundreds of articles in the leading newspapers in the Arab world and the Muslim world. The top leadership of the local jihadist movement took Al-Qaeda on and directly blamed Al-Qaeda for endangering the survival of the Islamic community and the Islamist movement as a whole. And surely, I mean, just if you can stay with me for a second on this particular point, look what happened when Russia invaded Afghanistan in 1979, 1980. What happened when Russia invaded Afghanistan? The call for jihad echoed from every single mosque in the Muslim world. More than 200,000 Muslims basically went to Afghanistan to fight the invading Russian forces that invaded Afghanistan. When we, the United States, invaded Afghanistan to basically expel Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, I said that fewer than dozens of people went to Afghanistan to defend the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And this goes a long way to show that 9/11 was not really, that Osama bin Laden, Ayman Zawahiri basically got it wrong, that the Muslim community and the Muslim ummah at large were not really very basically receptive to the call for global jihad by Osama bin Laden and by Ayman Zawahiri. Let's talk about Iraq. I said that in Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri got it wrong. That hardly just few dozen Muslims decided to go and fight in Afghanistan. You might say that Iraq was godsend event for Osama bin Laden, because surely we invaded Afghanistan, Iraq under false pretext. That we know that Saddam Hussein, bloody as he was, he did not have non-conventional weapons. Saddam Hussein did not really have any role in 9/11. In fact, even though that Iraq supplied ideological ammunition to Al-Qaeda, but most Iraqis were not really interested in the global jihad message of Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri. In fact, even though most Iraqis were opposed to the American military presence in Iraq, they did not buy into the global jihad message of either Osama bin Laden or Ayman Zawahiri. In fact, one would argue that the global jihad crashed on the rocks of the local concerns of the Iraqi community. In fact, the utter failure of Al-Qaeda's in Iraq testifies to the structural impediment facing the bin Laden group in establishing a viable social base in the Muslim world. I mean, ironically, think how easy it is for Al-Qaeda to have established a viable base in Iraq. Here you have a country that was invaded by the United States. Here you have a country that most Muslims basically opposed the American invasion and occupation of Iraq. Most Iraqis, I'm generalizing a great deal, were opposed to the American military presence in Iraq, and yet, Iraqis did not buy into the global message, the global jihad message perpetrated by Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri. A poll recently taken in Iraq by the BBC and the Washington Post, and this is just a recent poll, found that almost 100% of Iraqis basically did not want Al-Qaeda to exist in Iraq. And in fact, almost 90% of Iraqis did not want Al-Qaeda volunteers to come and fight on their behalf against the United States of America. I mean, astonishing results. You would have expected the Iraqi public opinion, and the poll showed, according to the BBC and the Washington Post, that there were no differences between Sunni Iraqis or Shiite Iraqis when it came to Al-Qaeda. Even though Sunnis and Shiites opposed the American military presence, they did not want Al-Qaeda to be part of their resistance against the United States. And the big point I'm trying to make here is that Al-Qaeda's failure in Iraq is part of a broader and greater existential crisis that has sapped Al-Qaeda's strengths and bled it dry in the Muslim world. If Al-Qaeda cannot succeed in establishing a viable social base in Iraq, a country that has received tremendous, coverage in the Muslim world, I wonder where could Al-Qaeda basically establish a viable base? This is a major development, and we would have expected Al-Qaeda to basically succeed in establishing a popular base in the country. This brings me to Al-Qaeda today. I want to make two major points that is about Al-Qaeda today. I would argue that Al-Qaeda faces a two-pronged threat to its very existence in the Muslim world today. The first threat facing Al-Qaeda is that the massive erosion of bin Laden's claim to legitimacy in the Muslim world. In the last 8 years, there has been a massive erosion of legitimacy for Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri in the Muslim world, and I'm going to say a few words about it. It's very critical, this particular point, why the massive erosion of public support is critical to understanding where Al-Qaeda is today and the future of Al-Qaeda itself. And the second point, which is related to the first, is that there has been a fierce revolt against Al-Qaeda from within, that is, top leaders, former top leaders of Al-Qaeda have revolted against Al-Qaeda. I'm going to say a few words about that, to basically, if we can agree, to see where Al-Qaeda is heading from here based on this, what I call the two-pronged crisis faced by Al-Qaeda. And I think the two points boil down to a massive crisis of authority and legitimacy. That is, you cannot understand where Al-Qaeda is today without understanding the massive crisis of authority and legitimacy that Al-Qaeda faces today. And this massive crisis of authority and legitimacy goes to the very heart of whether Al-Qaeda could succeed in establishing a viable social base. If my argument is correct, and it could not be, I could be wrong on this, and I have been wrong many times before. If the primary target of 9/11 is the Muslim world, because remember, Al-Qaeda can never dream of taking on the United States and defeating the United States on the battlefield. This is common sense. This is not a war to defeat the United States. The war itself, the target of the war, was to convince the Muslim world that Al-Qaeda is the vanguard. Al-Qaeda could defend the Muslim community. If my argument is correct, then the massive crisis of authority and legitimacy goes to the very heart of whether Al-Qaeda is a viable organization. That it tells us that Al-Qaeda has failed in a very catastrophic way to convince the Muslim population that it's a viable organization, that basically it could defend the Muslim community vis-a-vis the Western countries. I want to share with you some of the recent surveys that have been conducted by some of the leading polling institutes in the Western countries and the Muslim world, just to give you a glimpse, and I'm simplifying a great deal. My research is not just based on my own research, but I also use all kind of data collected in the last few years. A Gallup poll conducted over between 2001 and 2007 in 35 predominantly Muslim countries. It's one of the largest polling survey in the history of polling in the Muslim world in 35 Muslim countries, found that more than 90%, actually 94%, of respondents denounced the killings of civilians and non-combatants by Al-Qaeda on religious and moral ground. More than 90% of Muslim public opinion denounced the killing of civilians, and this is the point, of civilians on moral and religious ground. Because remember what Osama bin Laden has been saying for the last 8 years, that basically he is using religious terms. He is using religious terms to basically justify and rationalize his assault and killing of civilians. And here, Gallup poll showed that more than 90% of Muslims basically denounce the killings by Al-Qaeda on religious and moral ground, and this tells us that Al-Qaeda's message has not resonated with the bulk of Muslim public opinion. Another poll by an academic organization called Terra Free Tomorrow found that, and here, this is a very important poll taken in the last 2 years in Saudi Arabia. Remember, Saudi Arabia is the home base of Osama bin Laden. You would expect, I mean, you've heard so much about Wahhabism and fundamentalism and extremism in Saudi Arabia. You would expect, at least, to find that Osama bin Laden message to resonate in Saudi Arabia. Right? What did the poll found in the last 2 years? Actually, fewer than one in ten in Saudi Arabia has a favorable opinion of Al-Qaeda. Fewer than one in ten. And 89% of citizens in Saudi Arabia, one of the most fundamentalist state in the Muslim world, as fundamentalist, you say, as Afghanistan in the 1990s, basically approve of the crackdown by the authorities in Saudi Arabia against Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. A major, major, I mean, finding for us, we're trying to track Muslim public opinion. Another poll conducted in Pakistan. Take Pakistan. Everything that we have heard about Pakistan, you would expect that Pakistani public opinion is all in favor of Al-Qaeda. If I ask you, any one of you here, you would say, yes, Al-Qaeda is very popular in Pakistan, Afghanistan, because we have seen an increase in suicide bombings, we have seen an increase in inflammatory rhetoric, and so on and so forth. What do the polls in Pakistan tell us about Al-Qaeda's message? Remember, I'll come back to what I call the counter-argument. We're going to talk about the counter-arguments because there are some realities that basically prove that Al-Qaeda has built a particular base in Pakistan, on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. 1% of Pakistanis said if they were asked to vote for Osama bin Laden, only 1% of Pakistanis would vote for Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden does not really provide a vision, they said, for either Pakistan or the Muslim world. Again, this is a major, major finding about Muslim public opinion, and I'll say in a minute, I'll explain why what all those data, I mean, those accumulated evidence tells us a great deal about where Al-Qaeda was and where is Al-Qaeda today. A major poll by the Pew Survey, you've heard at Harvard University, I mean, this is one of the major, showed that in Jordan, Pakistan and Indonesia and Lebanon and Bangladesh, there were a substantial decline in the percentages saying that suicide bombings and other forms of violence could be justified on either religious ground or political ground. In fact, the shift has especially been dramatic in Jordan because Jordan, after 9/11, there was a sizable element of Jordanian public opinion that basically looked favorably about on Al-Qaeda. In Jordan now, almost 86% of Jordanian public opinion views Al-Qaeda in a very hostile and negative sense. In fact, in Pakistan, and this is, again, the polls are truly very interesting and fascinating for all of us, 86% in Pakistan and Bangladesh believe that suicide bombings and targeting civilians can never be justified under any conditions, 86%. Well, some of you might say, still, 86% leaves us what? 14%. This is a large number of Pakistanis and Muslims who still think that suicide bombings are justified under certain conditions. Let's compare those figures in Bangladesh and Pakistan and Jordan with figures from the United States itself, my country. What do Americans say about targeting civilians? In fact, the polls that we have taken in the United States, 46% of Americans think that bombing and other attacks intentionally aimed at civilians are never justified, while 24% believe those attacks are often or sometimes justified for military and efficacy reasons. the figures in the United States, what we have, and this is really, I just want to give you an idea what's happening because the figures are fascinating. 24% of Americans believe that targeting civilians in war under certain conditions are justified, while in Pakistan and Bangladesh and other countries, the figures really we're seeing 14%, which is, it tells me that those figures in Muslim countries don't tell us anything about the uniqueness of the Muslim world, that the Muslim world is not unique here, that there is nothing unique about the Muslim world, and in fact, public opinion in the Muslim world is probably as hawkish as public opinion in Israel, probably less so, and the United States and itself. And this is a positive development, and I'll say a few words, where am I going with this particular evidence and why it's so critical that the crisis of authority and legitimacy tells us a great deal about where Al-Qaeda is today. In fact, confidence in Osama bin Laden has fallen in most Muslim countries in recent years. In Saudi Arabia, 90% of citizens in Saudi Arabia, his home country, don't have any confidence in Osama bin Laden. That basically 8 years after 9/11, those people first who cheered him after 9/11, they realized that the man basically, it's all talk and no. And basically the reason why there has been a major shift, but because targeting civilians, the killing of civilians, not just Muslim civilians, basically most Muslims don't think that targeting civilian is the way to go. So what? You might say, so what do those, I mean, you have told us about radical shift in Muslim public opinion. Why should we care? Why should we care about those major shifts in Muslim public opinion? The loss of Muslim public opinion means fewer recruits, fewer shelters, and fewer opportunities to replenish depleted foot soldiers and field lieutenants. You need Muslim public support because you need foot soldiers. You need Muslim public support because you need shelter. You need Muslim public support because you need opportunities to basically carry on the fight. In my recent travels in the Muslim world, in fact, Al-Qaeda has lost, it seems to me, the minds, if not the hearts, of the majority of Arabs and Muslims. Even those Muslims whose hearts basically who believe that Osama bin Laden is fighting a just war against the United States, they basically, in their minds, they realize that Osama bin Laden is not a friend of the Muslim world, that Osama bin Laden is a major liability. Most kids, most activists, most radicalized religious activists believe that resistance, that Al-Qaeda is not waging a legitimate resistance, that Hezbollah, the party of God in Lebanon, and Hamas, are legitimate resistance movement as opposed to Al-Qaeda, that is a terrorist movement. Major, major shift in public opinion and also in the views, in particular, of young Arabs and Muslims. I mean, take a look at what's happening to Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Who is chasing Al-Qaeda away in Iraq today? Basically, Sunni Arab tribes are chasing Al-Qaeda today in Iraq. The revolt by Sunni tribes in Iraq has done a major damage to Al-Qaeda's infrastructure in Iraq. The United States, of course, we've been fighting Al-Qaeda in Iraq for so many years, but what has made a critical difference in the fight in Iraq against Al-Qaeda was not the increase in American troops on the ground, it was the revolt by Sunni Arab tribes. Sunni Arab tribes have taken arms against Al-Qaeda, and this has done a major, major damage to Al-Qaeda. Take a look at Saudi Arabia. Who is chasing Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia? It's not just the government, but even Saudi public opinion. The same thing in Yemen, the same thing in Lebanon, the same thing in Jordan. So it's not just about the fact that Al-Qaeda has lost the support of Muslim public opinion, has enabled the governments in those societies to basically hammer a deadly nail in the coffin of Al-Qaeda and its affiliates in those countries. The loss of Muslim public support has had a detrimental effect on Al-Qaeda's operational abilities. I mean, think of how many messages has Osama bin Laden, Ayman Zawahiri have released in the last 7 years. How many times How many times have you heard Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri threatening to basically deliver death and horror on Western shores in the last 7 years, since 9/11? Has Al-Qaeda been able to deliver, to carry out on its threats against the United States and its allies? In fact, I would argue that Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri have been reduced to a static image and voice on television and the radio. And this, again, tells us a great deal about the decline in Al-Qaeda's operational ability. And the decline in Al-Qaeda's operational ability cannot be understood except by understanding the massive crisis of legitimacy and authority that has taken place against Al-Qaeda in the Muslim world. In fact, I would argue that the balance of forces has shifted dramatically against Al-Qaeda in the last 7 years. The balance of forces has shifted dramatically against Al-Qaeda in the last 7 years. Now, conceptually and operationally, Al-Qaeda is besieged internally and externally. In fact, I would argue that one of the major developments is not just our war against Al-Qaeda in the United States, that we are waging a war against Al-Qaeda. The damage done to Al-Qaeda internally has been much more effective to Al-Qaeda's ability to wage its war against the far enemy, or what they call the head of the snake, the United States and its allies. And in fact, what Al-Qaeda is facing today is its options are dwindling, its social base is shrinking, and in fact, Al-Qaeda now is facing a major operational difficulties trying to find recruits. I said earlier that now we're talking about few hundreds. The numbers are few hundreds, and the only base of support that exists for Al-Qaeda is on the Pakistan-Afghanistan tribal border areas. I want to summarize, because how much time do I have, Anne? This is where we are. I mean, we are that Al-Qaeda is facing a two-pronged threat in terms of a massive crisis of legitimacy and authority. That is, you have, and I didn't say anything about the revolt within, and this is a subject that I have written extensively on in the last few years. I've written a book on this, on the revolt against Al-Qaeda. Let me just mention two names, and probably the names don't mean anything to you, but for us, very, very important. One name is a cleric by name Salman Al-Oda. Salman Al-Oda is one of the leading clerics in Saudi Arabia. He was jailed in Saudi Arabia in the early 1990s for 10 years. He was the spiritual mentor of Osama bin Laden. In fact, in the 1990s, one of the reasons why Osama bin Laden decided to attack the government of Saudi Arabia, because the government basically incarcerated Salman Al-Oda. During Ramadan 2007, Salman Al-Oda released a public statement in Arabic. It's called A Letter to Brother Osama. It was discussed widely in leading newspapers and television. And in the letter, Salman Al-Oda says, "Brother Osama, you are responsible," and I'm paraphrasing, "you are responsible for all the misfortunes that have befallen the Muslim world since 9/11. Brother Osama, the Americans did not bring death and horror on Iraqis. You did. By targeting Americas, you supplied ideological ammunition to the anti-Muslim forces in the United States. It enabled the neoconservative to attack the United States." Salman Al-Oda, he said, "I want you to know you are violating the very basic values and principles of Islamic law and Sharia, because you are killing," he said, "civilians." And he said, "What did the Quran teach us? Not even a child or a woman or a priest or even a tree," he said. "Even if you uproot a tree, this is against our values." I mean, this is Salman Al-Oda, the spiritual mentor of Osama bin Laden, taking Osama bin Laden publicly on Al Jazeera television, one of the leading television stations. Another figure, I mean, I can go on, his name is Dr. Fadl. Again, Dr. Fadl was the mufti of jihad, of Al-Qaeda. He wrote the constitution of Al-Qaeda. He released his memoirs about 2 years ago, I mean, hundreds of pages calling Osama bin Laden a false prophet, calling on young Muslims not to listen to the message of Osama bin Laden because he said Osama bin Laden is misleading young Muslims and who are plunging themselves into death in Iraq and Afghanistan. Those figures, I'm just mentioning those names, because not only you have, loss of Muslim public support, you have some of the top leadership, former leadership of Al-Qaeda, revolting against Osama bin Laden because they are really genuine about the fact that what Osama bin Laden has done basically has demonized the image, has basically conveyed a horrible, negative, terrible image of Islam and Muslims in the Western world. And they say it. And this is for the first time in the last 3 or 4 years, they are directly holding Osama bin Laden responsible for the death and violence that has taken place in the Muslim world. So Al-Qaeda is facing a two-pronged threat, down from a few thousand militants and fighters to about between 300 and 500. The numbers are 300. I'm going to be on the conservative side and say 500. What's our strategy? We in the United States, those are the facts. What's our strategy today against Al-Qaeda? Well, our national intelligence strategy released a few months ago, we still perceive Al-Qaeda, we in the United States, to be the most existential threat to the United States of America. Our national defense strategy, released in 2008 and approved by Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, says Al-Qaeda will represent a major threat to the United States in the coming decades, in the next 20 or 30 years. And basically, Robert Gates believes that the threat of Al-Qaeda is as critical as the communist and fascist threats to Western societies. The national document says even if we win the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, this does not mean that we won. We have to wage the war for the next 2 or 3 or 4 decades. I mean, think about the disconnect between the reality on the ground, that is, what's happening to Al-Qaeda, our own defense strategy that we have been waging, all-out war, global war against this. And think of what this war has done to Al-Qaeda. Here we are, the United States of America, the greatest power in the world, militarily and economically, I don't know about economically anymore, versus Osama bin Laden, the United States, versus Osama bin Laden and the roving bands of jihadis along the Afghanistan-Pakistan borders. Think of this disconnect. Think of this particular divide, and think of how much damage this particular strategy has done to America's image and status in the world, and how much this particular strategy has enabled Osama bin Laden to say that, yes, I am the vanguard. I am trying to fight the United States of America. I am defending the Muslim community. Because there is plenty of evidence to suggest that Al-Qaeda's threat is, Al-Qaeda is on declining, that Al-Qaeda does not really represent. And yes, I think there is, I mean, the major threat that represented by Al-Qaeda is on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, and I know you're losing men and women quite often. No one is suggesting, please don't misunderstand me, I'm not suggesting that Al-Qaeda is not dangerous. I think this is the mistake we made before 9/11, because we said, well, a few thousand men do not really represent an existential threat. I mean, all it took was 19 men to kill 3,000 Americans. All I am suggesting is that we need to, when we talk about Al-Qaeda, we need to keep the nature of the threat in perspective. We need to be analytically nuanced and complex. We need to say that Al-Qaeda is dangerous, but Al-Qaeda does not represent a grave threat to Western civilization. That we don't need to wage all-out war and invest trillions of dollars in a war against a few hundreds of militants who are basically on the Afghanistan and Pakistan border. And to suggest that Al-Qaeda is synonymous with the Taliban is to enable Al-Qaeda to say that we are waging a war against American and Western imperialism in Afghanistan. I don't need to tell you that the Taliban is not synonymous with Al-Qaeda. that one of the mistakes we made in Iraq was to lump Al-Qaeda with Sunni public opinion that was waging resistance against the United States. It took us 5 years in Iraq, 5 years to realize that Al-Qaeda was different from Sunni public opinion. And it was only by making distinctions between those Iraqis who were waging a war against American military presence in Iraq that basically the war began to really turn, produce some results. And in the same way, what I fear now is that we are making the same mistake in Afghanistan by saying Al-Qaeda, which represents, which numbers about a few hundred militants and terrorists, is synonymous with the Pashtun tribes. The Pashtun tribes are basically, you're talking about millions of people here. The Taliban are part of the Pashtun tribes. And it seems to me that our strategy in the United States and the Western countries to say that Al-Qaeda is synonymous with the Pashtun tribes. Say what have we about the Pashtun tribes and the Taliban? I mean, regardless of whether we agree or disagree, surely the Taliban is not our cup of tea. That's not the question. But the Taliban and the Pashtun tribes who are waging a nasty war in Afghanistan are not the same as Al-Qaeda. And by lumping Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, Afghanistan, with the Pashtun tribes is to prolong the war and to provide Al-Qaeda with much more legitimacy than it does have. I want to conclude on several points. I think to summarize and in this particular sense is that, yes, Al-Qaeda is dangerous. Al-Qaeda could still carry out attacks against Western targets and against the United States and against Muslim societies. But Al-Qaeda is a fringe terrorist group similar to the various terrorist groups that existed in Europe in the 1960s and 1970s. That Al-Qaeda represents more of a security nuisance than a strategic threat. Our strategy must be proportional to the nature of the threat represented by Al-Qaeda. If our reading is correct, that somehow Al-Qaeda is facing a massive crisis of legitimacy and authority, instead of waging a war against imagined and real enemies, our strategy should be to work closely with Muslim societies in order to slay the beast. Because surely the most effective means to slay the beast is not to wage an all-out war and antagonize and alienate Muslim public opinion, but rather to work with Muslim public opinion to internally encircle and slay the beast. This is common sense. We don't have to be strategists to realize that. What this means is that we need to de-escalate militarily. The long war that we have been waging, we call it the long war, should be shortened. We should find ways to extract our forces from the heart of the Muslim world, because our military presence in the Muslim world is pouring fuel on a raging fire, is convincing Muslims that we in the West are waging a war against Islam and Muslims, not against Al-Qaeda. Because every time I ask a Muslim activist or a civil society, listen, Al-Qaeda, they tell me, give me a break. Al-Qaeda, it's nothing. It's just a few hundred people. You're waging a war against the entire Muslim. And essential, whether they get it or not, it's essential for us in Western societies to realize that, in fact, the war we have been waging in the last 7 years has been counterproductive to the strategic goal that we have, that is to defeat Al-Qaeda and to encircle Al-Qaeda and to slay the beast. And also it means we need to find ways and means to resolve the simmering conflicts in the region. I mean, again, I'm going to be talking on Monday on the Arab-Israeli conflict. On the one hand, let's be blunt about it. On the one hand, we say Al-Qaeda's terrorism by targeting civilian is terrorism, absolutely. By collectively targeting American civilians, it's terrorism. Yet, when some of our allies collectively target civilians, Arabs and Muslims, we should call it a spade, that's terrorism. If militant Hamas, fires homemade rockets against civilians, that's terrible, absolutely. We must denounce Hamas when Israeli forces systematically and relentlessly target civilians in order to force Palestinian population to revolt against Hamas, that's collective punishment of population. That's terrorism. What I'm trying to suggest is that there are some policy initiatives. It's not about polemical point. It's not about basically laying blame here and there, but about the fact we must have a consistent and systemic policy. Al-Qaeda's terrorism is terrorism, but also we must refrain ourselves, that we must maintain the moral compass. We cannot, on the one hand, we say we promote democracy and we are the leaders of the free world, we believe in human rights, and on, and then we ourselves and our allies perpetrate crimes that basically violate those very basic principles. It means trying to resolve one of the major fault lines in the region, that is the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It means helping to provide Israel with security and a fully independent and viable Palestinian state. Security for Israel, absolutely, and security for the Palestinians. It means we, in particular, and I'm talking as an American, it means we in the United States must maintain a distance from the bloody dictators who have been oppressing their population. That is, on the one hand, we cannot be the leader of the free world and the leaders of human rights, and at the same time be the supporters and maintain the corrupt and oppressive order that exists in the region. I know it's easier said than done, but we must find ways and means to maintain a healthy distance from the region. It means we must invest in the structural needs of the local populations, and I think be on the right side of history by realizing that at the end of the day, that the more we sustain this morally and oppressive order that exists in the region, the more we provide opportunities for false prophets like Osama bin Laden, Ayman Zawahiri. Thank you. Any questions?
As Dr. Drew just said earlier, he's happy to take questions. I suspect that there may be a lot of questions, and so would you keep them brief?
Do you stay here?
Yeah.
Yeah, please.
Yes.
Of course.
And do you believe, or is it possible, that bin Laden is only the pawn, as you suggested, and that he's been allowed to survive as a target for all the maneuvers of Bill?
Can you repeat that? Yes.
I think there is the notion that has gained credibility in some circles, that somehow 9/11 had not taken place. I mean, some people go that, or somehow that Osama bin Laden is a pawn in the great game of world politics. I don't buy this nonsense. I basically don't because I work on a region that is basically filled with conspiracy theories, and I mean it's the Middle East. It's all about conspiracy. During the Iraq War, here you have suicide bombings in Iraq on a daily basis. I used to go and sit down and talk to some of the most intelligent editors, leading editors, and said, no, Iraqis never carry out suicide bombings. It's the Americans and the Mossad services, the Israeli security service and the Americans. They look you straight. They really believe it. They really believe that Iraqis do not carry out suicide bombings against one another. How could they? They're Muslims. They're believers. The evidence is overwhelming. The evidence overwhelming that Osama bin Laden does exist. Ayman Zawahiri does exist. Al-Qaeda does exist. I like to believe that if the United States could find Osama bin Laden, they would find him, either kill him or bring him to justice. I think it's much more difficult than really we think. I mean, I don't think the Americans are basically keeping Osama bin Laden alive because they need Osama bin Laden to wage their endless war. At least that's my... it's really real. But the great game exists, and the great powers play, nasty politics and cynical politics. And just to answer your question very directly, did a small group of ideologues in the United States use 9/11 as a pretext to play empire, to social engineer, to try to wipe the slate clean? Absolutely, you're absolutely correct. It was used as a pretext in order to basically carry out more ambitious and false ideas. But I don't believe that Osama bin Laden is kept alive either by the United States or other great powers.
The sounds that seem to promote terrorism in Britain and Indonesia, could you say, could you elaborate on their connection?
Yes. Thank you for the questions. I mean, my talk today, the question is that since I focus mainly on Al-Qaeda Central, my talk today was about the bin Laden group as opposed to the various affiliates, the loose affiliates, the freelancers, the wannabe, the sleeper cells. You're talking about two movements here. I mean, we're talking about Al-Qaeda Central. After we in the United States decided to expand the war on terror and wage all-out war in many places in the world, you had a revolt by many young Muslims. And as a result, this was really what I call the spillover effects of the... I'm not suggesting that American foreign policy is fully to blame for the emergence of those sleeping cells and independent freelance fighters. But since 2003, we have witnessed the emergence of what we call independent freelancers, Muslims who feel very outraged by foreign policies in the United States and Britain. And in particular, this particular threat has been acute in Europe in particular, because unfortunately, Al-Qaeda's ideology has infiltrated less, of course, in Canada, and North America. North America has been very resilient because the Muslim communities in North America are relatively much more integrated into Canadian and American society than Europe. I'm sure you know that, a sizable number of Muslims in Europe is not fully integrated into European societies. They're ghettoized culturally, not just economically, culturally. And in this particular sense, the expansion of the war on terror, Al-Qaeda strategy, a small number of Muslims in Europe have basically been receptive to this particular ideology. We know the London bombings and the bombings in Madrid and so on and so forth. But according to the top intelligence leaders in Europe now, even in Europe, they're saying that the Muslim community now is really coming forth and giving intelligence to the community. And fewer Muslims in Europe basically are carrying out attacks against European targets. In fact, in North America and the United States, despite all the investigation in the United States since 9/11, not even a single sleeper cell in the United States. I don't know if you remember after 9/11, there was a great deal of talk about sleeping cells, about the fact that those sleeping cells would basically be activated any moment. We have spent hundreds of millions of dollars in the United States on trying to see whether there are any sleeping cells. And the consensus and the reality on the ground, there are no sleeping cells. In Europe, they're talking about now 2,000 potential radicalized. But the news, the most recent news is that the situation has improved tremendously. And in fact, I would argue the more we deactivate militarily, the more we find ways to integrate those, you might say, ghettoized young Muslims into European societies, the more we deactivate the minefields that basically enable Al-Qaeda to attract and incite young Muslims. You mentioned Indonesia. Indonesia, after 9/11, almost 89% of citizens said they had favorable views of Al-Qaeda. Now, you have more than 90% of Indonesians who say that Osama bin Laden does not really provide a vision for Muslims. And I think even Indonesia, public opinion has turned against al-Qaeda. In fact, if there is really one particular point I want to make tonight is that al-Qaeda has lost the struggle for Muslim minds. I don't know about Muslim hearts. That's a difficult question for us to answer. But fewer and fewer Muslims are responding to al-Qaeda's ideology. This does not mean that we in the United States have won the war of ideas. Please don't misunderstand me. That's not the question. Al-Qaeda has lost the war. We have not won the war. There's a great deal of suspicion of the United States. My take on it is that the election of Barack Obama will likely do a great deal of good. And I think already, I think he has a wonderful start. And I really believe that on multiple levels, that Barack Obama represents a nightmare for Osama bin Laden, because he represents everything that Osama bin Laden would like us to believe wrong about the United States. And I think I am, like many others, are very hopeful that Barack Obama basically not only would finally, close this bloody chapter in relations between the Muslim world and the West, but basically will really finish the war against al-Qaeda itself, not by fighting a military struggle, but by internally helping to encircle al-Qaeda, by building alliances with Muslim societies in order to basically finish this particular struggle. Well, we have, yes, the question, and again, another great question. I mean, I think my positive note does not take into account the gravity of the situation on the Pakistan-Afghanistan tribal areas. I think this is the most explosive theater. Pakistan and Afghanistan have emerged as the most fragile and dangerous theater. In fact, if al-Qaeda, while al-Qaeda has lost every single shelter and base in the Muslim world, still has a relatively safe shelter on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. Even all American institutions, including the military, believes that the war in Pakistan-Afghanistan cannot be won militarily. The Taliban are on the rise. The central government in Kabul does not really control the entire city, as you know. It controls just the perimeters around the presidential palace. If it was not for NATO forces, the Canadians and the British and the Germans, I think the Taliban would overtake Kabul very swiftly. But what I am suggesting to you, and this is the point, even the American military has recently come to the same conclusion, is that we would make a terrible mistake by equating the complex struggle in Afghanistan and Pakistan with al-Qaeda. This is a different type of struggle. This is more of a nationalist struggle between the Pashtun tribes. The Taliban come from the Pashtun tribes. The Pashtun tribes are a majority in Afghanistan, and also you have millions of Pashtuns in Pakistan as well. And they seem to believe that they are waging an anti-colonial war against the foreign forces in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I think my fear that President Barack Obama, during the campaign, he lumped the Taliban and the Pashtun tribes with al-Qaeda. I am delighted to hear that even President Barack Obama now is suggesting that the only way out of the deadly embrace in Pakistan and Afghanistan is a regionally sensitive political settlement, as opposed to winning the war militarily. That is, we must engage the geostrategic neighbors of Afghanistan and Pakistan, Iran, India, and try to find a settlement whereby the Pashtun tribes basically become part of the Afghanistan government and, in fact, de-escalate militarily. I like to believe that even though we are sending about 30,000 troops to Afghanistan in the next few months, that this is in order to really advance the negotiating position of the you might say, moderate voices in Afghanistan itself. That increasing American troops in Afghanistan is not designed to win the war militarily, which cannot be won, but rather is designed to help the international community reach a settlement, whereby President Karzai or the next president basically find a settlement with the Taliban. To be blunt, there is no way out of the particular struggle in Afghanistan without bringing the Pashtun tribes, some elements of the Taliban, whether we like it or not, that's not the question. We know that the Taliban are some of the most reactionary elements in Afghanistan. I mean, they're deadly, they're nasty, they're lethal, but that's not the question. They basically have tremendous support, and there are multiple voices within the Pashtun tribes. Let's hope that some more, I'm not going to use the word moderate because the word moderate is very misleading. Who are we to basically label the Pashtun tribes in terms of moderate? But let's say elements within the Pashtun tribes that accept a settlement whereby Afghanistan becomes a stable country, an orderly country, and basically expels global jihadists like Al-Qaeda. Because after all, the aim is not to basically defeat the Taliban. The aim is to prevent Afghanistan from becoming a shelter for the global jihad for Al-Qaeda. That's the aim. That's why the United States invaded Afghanistan after 9/11, was not really basically engaged in a social engineering project. In fact, the American government now is saying, we cannot promote democracy in Afghanistan a la America. We cannot basically engage in nation building. All we need to do is to find ways and means to reconstruct Afghanistan and help establish an orderly and more secure government.
Yes.
My question is based on a book I've read recently called Afghanistan.
Yes.
And
it's the book we talked about by the British journalist, the London Times journalist. And we had a debate here in Canada, actually, she and I, on the same question. Please.
Well, my question relates to the fact that, let's accept the fact that recruitment in England is not as attractive as it was, and the numbers of Al-Qaeda Central have gone down. That has been, over probably the last 6-7 years, I think, since we're presenting this week, and those numbers have gone down.
It's not a long question at all. I mean, the question is, yes, recruitment for Al-Qaeda has declined in the last 7 years, but does not mean that the threat is gone. Does not mean that basically recruitment could not increase in the future or will not increase in the future. The argument in the book, he mentioned a book by a London, this is a big debate taking place about the role of immigrants and the Muslim communities in Western societies. This is not really the place here, because I think the worst thing we can do is to basically talk about Islam and Muslims here. I am, as a student, this is not about Islam and Muslims. I mean, Al-Qaeda does not speak for Islam and Muslims. I mean, we must make a clear distinction on a variety of reasons, not because those are facts. Because Osama bin Laden would like us to believe that he speaks for Islam and Muslims, right? And in fact, what we did after 9/11 is that we basically acted on this particular premise, that this is a long war, that Al-Qaeda is not just a nasty fringe terrorist group. Al-Qaeda was an extension of a larger threat facing the West. That was the premise on which our policies were based. That's how we decided to expand the war on terror. Remember, after 9/11, two narratives competed in the United States and the Western world. One narrative said, Al-Qaeda is much greater and bigger than Osama bin Laden and the 4,000 militants that existed in the 1990s. This is part of an ideological struggle between the West and the rest. This is a struggle between the United States and the so-called Islamofascists. We lumped Al-Qaeda with all the religiously oriented groups, the mainstream, the moderate, everything. And we said, if this is so, we must wage a war, a crusade. It was a slip of tongue, President Bush said, and probably it was. And the policies we adopted after 9/11 was based truly on this particular premise. The second narrative, the